I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about one of the changes in education in Indiana, having the state take over low-performing schools. Few issues divide Hoosiers and education professionals more than this one. We will talk about this combustible issue with our guests, Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett, Indianapolis Public Schools Superintendent Eugene White, and Ed Power Chancellor Marcus Robinson. Please join the discussion by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or shooting a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the state takeover of under- or low-performing schools. We're fortunate to have as our guests Tony Bennett, who is the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of Indiana. Dr. Bennett, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
I should say welcome back. This is quite the return visit for you. Eugene White, who is superintendent of the Indianapolis Public Schools. Dr. White, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. And Marcus Robinson, who is Ed Power Chancellor. Marcus, welcome to the program.
A pleasure.
Well, we're talking about underperforming schools and the state takeover, which are relatively new change in the way we deal with education in this state. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm going to start first with you, Dr. Bennett, and ask, what is the rationale for having the state take over, having this mechanism in place?
Well, first, John, it's very important for the listeners and everyone to understand this is not a new thing in Indiana. It is the implementation of a law that's really been in existence since 2001. Public Law 221, which is the state's accountability law, sets forth a course of action for the state in the event that schools hit the lowest performance standard for six consecutive years. So between 2001, when the law was enacted, and 2011, we hit that place where seven schools were identified in that performance metric. So this is not a new issue. It is the first implementation of a public law that's been in existence for over a decade. And it's also part of a law that's very comprehensive that affords the state not just the authority to intervene intensively, which, you know, you've referred to as takeover, but also to enable us to use a more a different type of intervention, which we are also engaged with IPS, which is lead partners. So there is a menu of options for the state, and in this in five instances in the state exercised the most intense intervention. In two issues, we exercised a different intervention based on what we believe the needs of the students were. And again, it's the implementation of a decade old law.
Well, let me ask then, what are the standards for defining low performance or underperformance?
You know, again, this has been in existence since 2001, and it really does come down to our state's performance assessments. Most of these schools, four of these five schools, are high schools or junior, senior, or middle senior high school configurations. One is strictly a middle school, and so in the middle schools, they are I-STEP related. In the high schools, they're end of course assessment related. And in those combined high schools, they're both.
Dr. White, I'm going to ask you, is having the state take over schools a good idea? I'll start with that. Is it a good idea?
Well, I think the original intent of the law was meant to improve education in this state, and I was somewhat associated with the decision because I was on the committee there with Dr. Reed and some other people. It's a good idea to make sure that we improve education of every child in the state. We have no problem with the idea. Sometimes we get concerned with the process that you go through in this whole thing. But I think in working with DOE and the state board, they have really been responsive to some of the concerns that we have expressed. And I think they know that takeover is an adversarial process. It's not the best process to go through to get to where you want to get to. We've had better luck and better relations with the lead partner model, but I think it's something that's necessary, and it's going to change education in the state. There's no doubt about that.
How so? How is it going to change that? You'd mentioned you had some concerns about the process. I want to stick with that, and then I'm gonna take it back to Dr. Bennett. At some point, I want to get Marcus Robinson in this conversation too. But yeah,
while a concern, quite frankly, we were in two different elements here. The element we're in now, dealing with growth and improvement, is, I think, the fairest way to go. In terms of just state test scores, I think that is not always the best for kids in low-poverty school districts. I think there is a definite correlation between the schools that were taken over. That's not meant to be an excuse. That's just the reality of the situation. But now that we're into the growth mode and we judge schools based on their progress on state assessment, I think that particular adjustment in the process is something that we can definitely live with, because every school is then accountable for its own progress. So to me, that's a positive step forward.
Is there I probably should ask the question here, because I know you guys live in the world of education and throw these terms around constantly. Could you explain, Dr. Bennett, the difference between sort of the lead partner as opposed to the takeover?
Sure, and let me start by saying this, John. My personal philosophy as state superintendent is state takeover should be the last option, the absolute last option. As a matter of fact, we seek changes to Public Law 221 that give Dr. White and other superintendents like Dr. White greater flexibility to fix their problems first, because there's no question the best model is a model where the local school district can address its own issues, and we are aggressively seeking those changes. But let me answer your question very directly. The easiest way to understand it is the state Department of Ed is responsible for recommending an intervention that is consistent with what the department believes the needs of the school are. So the lead partner is looking at, and let's use Broad Ripple and George Washington. We assigned lead partners to Broad Ripple and George Washington, believed based on the very specific needs of those schools. The biggest difference is the lead partner works with the Department of Education and Indianapolis Public Schools in this instance, and it works on targeted interventions. Mm-hmm. But the schools remain under the control of Indianapolis Public Schools. In a takeover situation, the schools are removed from the governance of Indianapolis Public Schools and assigned to a private operator. That's the basic difference.
Well, and I think that's actually a point where we bring Marcus Robinson into this conversation. He's the chancellor for Ed Power. How do you get drawn into this process?
We were invited to apply to become a turnaround school operator for the state of Indiana. And I think the compelling issue for us was Arlington High School, where we've been asked to intervene. It's 6 minutes door to door. Mm-hmm. From our offices. These are students that live in the neighborhoods that we serve, have family members in our school community for the last 8 or 9 years. And so it made sense for us, if someone was going to do an intervention, it ought to be somebody who understood the context, the neighborhood, the population.
Well, and then let me ask this. What can you do that the existing administration of the school system cannot? What powers or options, what makes your chances of success greater than theirs?
Well, I mean, I think Dr. Bennett already alluded to the kind of constraints that are on superintendents like Dr. White. As it pertains to labor, as it pertains to some of the kind of curricular aims that they can get at. We have some flexibility. I mean, this is kind of martial law, but we have a very tight time window in which to make some changes and to show some real growth outcomes for the students in the school as well.
How tight is that time window you're talking about?
We've got 4 years to go from single-digit proficiencies to above 50%.
Okay, so you've got to show then a 500% growth rate. Is that, if my Absolutely. Math is correct?
Absolutely.
I realize I'm a journalist. We're not supposed to do math, but it sounds like that's the standard
sure.
by which we are talking about the state taking over underperforming schools. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We have gotten a couple of email questions from a listener named Keith. First one is for Tony Bennett. It says, in July, there was a donation of $200,000 made to you from a Walton in Arkansas. What is this money being used for?
Well, it's an interesting question because, first of all, that donation, that contribution was actually made to my political campaign for the purposes of re-election. So it has it's not even germane to this discussion.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think whenever they hear education as such, and that's the Walton family, though, to be clear, that's underwritten a lot of the voucher campaigns around
sure,
the country.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
So, and for Dr. White, why was IPS not present at the enrollment day after the mayor canceled the Project Schools charter? There were two other charters and a handful of Catholic schools present, but not IPS.
We had been working with the families of the Project School, and we had extended an invitation for them to apply. We had made available to them information on magnet options and community school options for them, and we were initially planning to attend. However, once the judge stepped in and they were going to have a hearing, we did not want to be seen as trying to interfere or disrupt the process, recruiting kids when they still thought they had a chance to keep them. And so we just pulled them out of that particular situation. They know where we are, they know who we are, and they know the programs that are available. And after the judge made his decision, we have continued to be as open as we can, providing possible options for the parents and students from the Project Schools to choose from.
Dr. White, you said earlier that this option of having the schools being taken over is going to change education in Indiana. What did you mean by that? What changes do you think it's going to bring about?
I think it puts everybody on a greater sense of urgency. I think it has created situations where you really can't hide and behind averages. I think that it has produced a kind of pressure, but it's not alone. You got to understand, this goes with the new teacher evaluation. It goes with the new accountability standards. It is a comprehensive kind of movement, but the movement in itself, which includes interventions or possible takeovers, that whole movement is going to change the face and outcome of education in this particular state.
We are talking about state takeover and interventions in low-performing, underperforming schools here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And as we talk about education today, we want you to know that WFYI is part of American Graduate, a public media initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help address the dropout crisis. The initiative builds on our commitment to education through conversations and partnerships between public radio and television stations and local schools, businesses, and community organizations to help students stay on the path to a high school diploma. We are talking, as I said, about state takeover of underperforming schools. I'm fortunate to have as my guests Dr. Tony Bennett, Dr. Eugene White, and Marcus Robinson. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the state takeover of underperforming schools. My guests are Tony Bennett, who is the superintendent of public instruction for the state of Indiana, Eugene White, who is the superintendent of schools, Indianapolis Public Schools, and Marcus Robinson, who is Ed Power Chancellor. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Diane, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
I have a question for Dr. White. Dr. White, I live in IPS district, and I personally take my son to a township school. Because due to the violence and things that go on in the school, and it just seems like they're in total chaos on my side, on the west side of town, the Northwest High School District. And it just seems that there's nothing that's being done about that. Kids like my son who have a higher learning ability, he personally said, "Mom, I can't go to this school. The teachers aren't in control. You know, the kids control the classroom." I wanted to see if there was anything that you guys had coming down the pike with regard to that, so that parents like me don't have to take our kids out of IPS.
What grade level is your child?
Going into the eighth grade.
Well, it's ironic. We are opening a new college academy high school at the Gamble School right there at the corner of Keel and 38th Street. Mm-hmm. Stars this year as the college prep academy. Mm-hmm. Students do have to have a certain test score to get in, but that is a college prep school. We're starting with ninth graders this year. Next year it'll be ninth and tenth graders. We're going to add a grade a year, but it will be an inquiry-based high school program, and is meant to accommodate students coming out of our gifted and talented academy, our Montessori schools, our inquiry-based schools, so it would be a very positive option for your child when he got to the ninth grade next year. You can come to the Magnet Fair in November, and you should receive a lot of additional information. You are welcome to visit the school, and I don't have the address, but you can see it from 38 Keel right there, and they would be glad to give you a tour and let you see the school.
Thank you for the call, Diane. I want to broaden that conversation a little bit, because I think what she's alluding to are conditions that you know, technically don't fall into the traditional definition of education, but, and I think Dr. White had alluded to that earlier in the show when he said that there's a correlation between schools that are in poverty-stricken areas and the underperforming schools. Does this mechanism take into account those other factors beyond the resource? Dr. Bennett.
Well, as Dr. White knows, we, under Public Law 221, at year four, if we can kind of back up to answer the question, John, at year four, we send a team in. Using what's referred to as the Mass Insight model, which is a school evaluation model, very popular around the country, very comprehensive in nature. And we really look at three areas: ready to lead, ready to teach, ready to learn. Okay. And again, the entire, not the school culture, the instructional components, and also the leadership are all evaluated. So when you ask that question, at year four, when schools have had four consecutive years, that is triggered, that evaluation is triggered at the state level. And those are, the outcome of that evaluation is then shared with the administration of the schools with the school board and the decision makers in an effort that the next 2 years they can maybe address those issues. But those very issues you talk about are part of the comprehensive evaluation we do after year four.
We are talking about underperforming schools here on No Limits, and we have gotten a question via Facebook from a listener named Vicky who says, if your child is in a turnaround school, could your child go to another school? I'll toss that one back to you, Dr. Bennett.
I think I understand the question when she says to another school. So I think, first of all, school choice in Indiana, as you alluded to when the listener asked a question about the Walton contribution, school choice in Indiana is about as robust as anywhere in the United States. Students can go from one Indianapolis public school to another Indianapolis public school. As the one caller mentioned, that students can go from an Indianapolis public school to a township school or from a township school to an IPS school, which I know Gene has a number of those. Students can go from charter to public school to charter. We have students on vouchers. So if a student is in a turnaround academy, I am certain that Dr. White would accept those students in another IPS school, or if the townships take students, if that is their policy, they too would take students. So again, the robust nature of school choice encompasses our turnaround academies as well.
John, we gave our students in those turnaround schools three choices. They could stay in the turnaround school, or they could have two IPS choices, so they had choices.
Loretta, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. Your question, please.
Well, I have several.
Okay, do them quickly then.
Well,
thank you.
What is Tony Bennett's experience with inner city, urban, poor, poverty schools? I've read part of his resume. And also, I've been living in Indianapolis over 70 years, mm-hmm. was educated in public schools. Why are all these problems now? As our teachers, I would think, would be more qualified, better educated than they were when I was going to school. And also, why are we outsourcing when a school is taken over by a corporation outside the state of Indiana? Why are we not using Indiana people? You know, it's the same theory as the nation. Why are they outsourcing to other countries? Why are we outsourcing to other states and other corporations outside of Indiana?
Good questions, Loretta. I think we're going to take a few minutes to address those.
I'm sorry.
No. Please do not apologize. Those are great questions. They really are good questions.
I think those are probably directed at me, right,
John? Yes, pretty much. I think Marcus may have caught at least the end of that one.
Let me address, and Loretta, if I don't, I may get into an answer, and if I forget one, just remind me that I've forgotten a question. The first question, what experience do I have, is first I was, to start, an assistant superintendent at New Albany Floyd County Schools, which by its very definition, by its demographics, was part of the Urban Schools Association that Dr. White belongs to as IPS. It was a group of schools. Our superintendent, who now works for me, Dr. Dennis Brooks, was a member of the Urban Schools Association. It does have an inner city high school, a large inner city high school, New Albany High School, that frankly characterizes many of the demographics that we see in virtually all urban schools. From New Albany Floyd County Schools, I took over as superintendent of Greater Clark Schools, which has it's almost like a mirror image of New Albany Floyd. It too was a member of the Urban Schools Association. I chose not to belong when I became superintendent, but it too, and these were both schools of around 10 to 11, school districts of around 10 to 11,000 with urban centers that we serve. So, you know, I never served in Indianapolis public schools, it would be wrong to assume that I don't have any experience with urban centers and urban populations, because both of those districts would be characterized as part of the urban schools group in Indiana. I'm going to jump a little bit to your third question about why were sources outside of Indianapolis chosen, and it's a very interesting question. The first reason is, as Dr. White mentioned, this issue of school intervention is a national phenomenon. This is not strictly specific to Indiana. I would suggest, Loretta, first and foremost, the number or the availability of operators to do this is frankly very limited. And there is huge competition across the country for this work. There are fewer people doing this work than the need we have across the country. So we didn't have the number of, if you will, operators in Indiana to actually take on this work. So yes, we did go out and we did vet. And believe me, we started with a lot more people than we ended up choosing for this. Frankly, we would have been much more satisfied had we had more operators from Indiana with the qualifications that maybe Ed Power brought to us. But frankly, I think every state is challenged with that. Now, I'd also know, but that's why we did go out of state. You asked me a question in between the first and the third, and I'm going to ask you to refresh my memory.
Well, Loretta, are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, your second question, why now?
Why all these problems now?
Okay.
I mean, I know life's changed, but our teachers are certainly more qualified than they were 25, 50 years ago. They're better educated. So why all these problems now? Is it poverty or social economic reasons or what?
Well, I'm going to take that question offline, Loretta, because we got people waiting to get on. If you'd keep listening. But thank you very much for the great questions.
And thank you for your time and your information.
Certainly. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, and let's take that question. I'll pull Dr. White back into the conversation. Why now?
Well, I think what happened, John, was as the result of all the international assessments, it was very clear that the United States was falling further and further behind in terms of our performance against countries like India, China, Germany, and what have you. And the governors and others came together to look at it, and they decided that something had to be done. And over in the last 15 years, there has been a movement to make us more competitive as a nation. And because of that need to make us more competitive, they have ramped up the standards that students need to meet. They've ramped up instructional expectations, instructional supervision expectations. The benchmarks have been ramped up. Matter of fact, quite frankly, what they used to get in first grade, they get in kindergarten now. Everything is ramping to a higher level. We know more about what it takes for students to learn. My only concern is, in an urban setting, we have to do something about preschool, early childhood education, to fill the gap of readiness that we have in many of our families, because we have evidence and data to prove that four-day kindergarten has resulted in substantial improvement in our students' performance. And that's the result of getting 65 to 75% of our kindergartners ready for first grade. If we can get 90% of them ready, we could reduce special ed by half and performance would really, really improve. So in addition to what's happening in the political scene and the reform movement, we also have started to look locally and statewide to say, what can we do to be more competitive and prepare our students more? And it really starts and ends in the classroom, but it deals with supports, it deals with interventions. And in our case, we have a law that's very, very clear. Like Dr. Bennett said, I was on the Education Roundtable that really passed the PL 221. And when it was passed, I think no one thought that it would ever come to this, but no one looked at the international situation and our competitiveness and that internationally. And now that's what's driving. You know, we don't have the factories available for people who finish high school or drop out of school anymore. You got to have more skills. We'll have more preparation. So everything is ramped up.
It's a more sophisticated economy.
And if you ramp up everything, you have to ramp up instruction and education.
That's the point I would want to make.
So you have increased expectations for students, but we don't necessarily have a higher quality of instruction. Mm-hmm. Our schools of education are not turning out the kids that our inner cities need in order to educate the children in them.
What are they not doing right?
Well,
Marcus Robinson.
When we talk about our students who live in poverty, we don't talk about them being underprivileged. We talk about them being under-resourced. Mm-hmm. You know, when I worked in private and independent schools, I didn't have brighter kids. I didn't have more committed kids. I had kids with money. Mm-hmm. And money could buy you tutoring. Money could buy you summer programs. If you lived in a house with someone with multiple degrees who didn't have a day job, mm-hmm. you had access to a different context when you went home. And so for people who come to inner cities to teach, they can't merely go through the traditional training program I went through a couple decades ago. Mm-hmm. They have to come to the table ready to work longer. Mm-hmm. To get out of summer vacations. I mean, some kids are going to need 12 months out of the school year to work, and they're going to need the kind of strategies that inner city kids find engaging. Mm-hmm. And so I would say we've got to ramp up our expectations for what it means to get into teacher education and then what it means to get those people trained. When you come work at our organization, it takes us a month to try to get a teacher ready for the classroom. That's how serious the situation is. And so we've got to get better instruction in front of these kids, or it doesn't matter what the intervention is.
I've got to say, and I think it was Dr. White who used the term adversarial about this takeover process. I mean, is the fact that so much of the education debate now is adversarial by its nature.
Well, John,
is that inhibiting us solving the problem? I'll go with Dr. White, and then I'm going to give Dr. Bennett a chance.
Well, first of all, I have to say amen to what Marcus said, and therein lies the great difference in Marcus and us in traditional education. He has more flexibility to get those type of things incorporated, and I deal with another set of restrictions or regulations, and so that's a big plus there. But John, in terms of the question you wanted me to respond to, that I got off on the
It's about the nature of how adversarial this debate has become.
If you look at the history of change, mm-hmm. it would be unusual if it wasn't adversarial. When you have major changes in this country, you have winners and losers. You have those who are impacted, those who might not be, and around that, you create that friction of the change. And I think that it's kind of built into major change. Add that to a paradigm shift in the voucher, the charters against traditional public education, and it creates all kinds of friction and tension. And I think that's just a part of the scenario now.
And I'm going to let Dr. Bennett have a quick word here.
John,
I want to get to callers because we've got them lined
John,
up.
John, it's really mm-hmm. kind of an interesting dynamic in that I think you talk about adversarial. I mm-hmm. think, first of all, people associate me with kind of the reform movement. I think we as reformers, so mm-hmm. to speak, as a label, have allowed ourselves to be caricatured as angry. Mm-hmm. I don't think it helped some of the publicity that came out of the reform movement, some of the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And I think the very intriguing piece is that while the Department of Education and IPS on the surface has this adversarial relationship, if anybody ever sees Tony Bennett and Gene White together, you would have a hard time making that case. Because what folks need to understand is that the three people sitting at this table, while we sit at different places along the circle, all of us have a huge heart for doing what's best for children. We just may have different beliefs on how to get there.
We are talking about the state takeover of underperforming schools, which has become really a conversation about what we need to do with education, period, which is a good topic. And as we talk about education today, we want you to know that WFYI is part of American Graduate, a public media initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help address the dropout crisis. The initiative builds on our commitment to education through conversations and partnerships between public radio and television stations and local schools, businesses, and community organizations to help students stay on the path to a high school diploma. We are talking about education today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. My guests are Tony Bennett, Eugene White, and Marcus Robinson. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the state takeover, at least we started talking about the state takeover of underperforming schools, and have really started talking about what we need to do to improve education in general. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. I was wanting to ask you, gentlemen, about the charter schools. Won't this only draw the more intelligent kids to the charter schools and leave the less intelligent kids in the public schools?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, David.
No, on the contrary, if you look at IPS, our students, and it's not really about intelligence. It's kind of like what Marcus said. It's about parents, many of whom have college education or what have you, who want their kids to have a good education. We're not losing them to charters per se. They're going to our magnet schools. Now, there are some that may go to charters, but the great majority of students that IPS lose to charter schools are single-parent kind of families and parents who want a greater opportunity for their children and believe that the particular charter can deliver on that. But no, we don't see the greatest or the brightest kids necessarily going to charters. As a matter of fact, our brightest kids are at our gifted and talented school, and they've been number one on state tests for three of the last 4 years, and their score for 2012 was 99.6% of the kids passing. So bright kids we have. It's more dynamic than just a flight of a particular group of students.
And John, let me also, if I may add to David's question, he asked about, you know, the higher achieving kids fleeing. A very interesting dynamic we saw is outside the charter, but even to our schools that take vouchers, their scores actually declined, which said to us that our schools that were accepting vouchers weren't really cherry-picking the best students. You know, they were not really cherry picking the best students. They were serving children who had needs. So it's a very interesting dynamic, which goes back to, and again, this is a huge issue of debate, is why I believe we do need such choice, because Gene offers incredible choice in IPS. Marcus offers different choices, and different schools offer different choices. And this is a very diverse society with diverse needs for a diverse 21st century workforce.
We are talking about underperforming schools here on No Limits. Sandy, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Your question, please.
Well, I have more of a comment than a question. I agree that early childhood education is important, but a lot of the students that you're referring to that need the teachers to put in extra hours and, you know, year-round teaching, we need to focus on adult education, because a lot of parents do not have a high school diploma, a GED, or the ability to write or read above, you know, a sixth grade level. And I think we need to implement more programs that would draw the adults out and to help them stop the cycle, because the teachers cannot do it all.
Thank you very much for the call, Sandy.
Thank you.
Certainly. Well, that is more of a comment, but do we make a mistake here in thinking about the schools as the only place where education takes place? Which
it's
is
the only thing, John. We have. The only thing Gene White. It's the only thing Gene controls. It's the only thing Marcus controls, is the quality and the instruction in their classrooms.
Right, and parents get drawn to school where their kids are successful.
Right.
Right. So I deal with parents, some of whom had really bad experiences as students themselves, and so they don't see the school as an inviting place until their kids have some success.
I have an even more dynamic situation. I had a school that improved 22.7% on the ISTEP test this spring, and 85% of the students in the school are Hispanic Latino, and two-thirds of them speak English as a second language, and my parents can't even understand English, but when I go to speak there, I have to meet in the gym. And the gym is full, and they're nodding their head, yes. They don't know what I'm saying. I have an interpreter. I go to some of my communities, and I can meet in a telephone booth. Now, the difference is that that group of parents still believe in the American dream, mm-hmm. and know that they know that the education is the way, and they don't have any education, some of them, but they know that's the out. We need supportive parents, and they don't need a college degree. Quite frankly, they don't need a high school degree, but they need to be supportive, and they need to buy into coming to the school, making sure kids are doing what they should do, and we can take it from there. And that's the parent involvement is a critical variable in helping us to do what we need to do.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Matt for Marcus Robinson, and it says, "Sir, a freshman class at Tenley starts out with 60 to 70 students, yet only 14 or 15 will graduate. How do you justify saying that you have a 100% success rate at your school?"
Yeah, well, we've never had a freshman class with 50 or 60 students, I guess, first. Mm-hmm. We actually started sixth grade. So we had a sixth grade class start with 50-something students. And now in their senior year, our first group of sixth graders are hovering somewhere around 40. We have an early college program that requires our students to take 2 years of college history, 2 years of college English, a year of college philosophy, and a year of college calculus in order to get their high school diploma. And so we do have some students who, after middle school, choose to move to a less rigorous kind of environment. I think as an eighth grader, I probably would have made a similar decision. and so, you know, we are certainly concerned that we want to graduate 100 kids, 200 kids, but that meant growing younger down to sixth grade. Our initial group of ninth graders really struggled in that program. Eventually, we'll grow down to kindergarten. And so in order for us to get to that place, to Dr. White's point, we have to start earlier with our kids.
And we've gotten a question. I think I'll throw this one to Tony Bennett from a listener named Shannon, who says, "Why don't students already going to private schools have access to vouchers? When will this change?
Well,
or will it?
I'm not sure. That'll be a discussion in the General Assembly. Let me say why it really started that way, and it had to do with fiscal impact. Mm-hmm. In the 2011 General Assembly, the mandate was that that the initiative could not cost the state money. And by including students previously in private schools, it would have obviously addressed our tuition cap, or the number of students we serve, and we couldn't do that in a fiscally neutral manner. I also think there was a prevailing attitude in the General Assembly that, frankly, that public schools should get the first shot at the students, and that was a discussion that was actually that actually took place on the floor of the chambers. So a couple of reasons, but I would say first and foremost, the situation started as a fiscal impact issue.
And we probably differ, John, mm-hmm. In terms of Tony and I on this, because I really think there's a conflict when you support vouchers. The kid goes to a school, a Catholic school, that teaches Catholic principles, and they go through all of that, and the public is paying for it, just like the students we have going to the Jewish school, and the public is paying for that. We think that. Quite frankly, is public funds being used for private institutions, and that concerns us because Indiana is moving to a place where mm-hmm. any student at any particular school like that can qualify for vouchers, and since we have finite resources, there are going to be fewer dollars for kids in traditional public schools.
And there is litigation. There is litigation on that point right now. And I've lost track of it. I know at the trial court level, the judge pretty firmly upheld the voucher law and said that once the money, the voucher moved into the parents' hands, it became a matter of personal discretion.
Right, right. Sure, and it is in front of it will be in front of the Supreme Court.
We are talking about education in general. We started talking about state takeover of underperforming schools here on No Limits. Mike, welcome to the program.
Yes.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Yes, it's for Dr. Bennett. Schools, they can't fix the biggest problem, which is poverty, and parents' involvement will be the biggest factor in a child's success. And it seems like things like the charter school pulling kids out and merit-based pay for the teachers, which gives them no incentive for people to join the profession. It seems to be almost geared towards making the schools fail And is this part of a privatization issue? That was it.
Thanks for the question, Mike.
Well, first, Mike, let me say this. If our intent was to make the private schools failed, we have failed. Mm-hmm. Because the fact is, I think every academic indicator in the state is up. Mm-hmm. Our student performance is up, and on ISTEP, on every state assessment, Indiana ranks second currently over the last 2 to 3 years in performance and improvement on advanced placement tests. Advanced placement courses are a leading indicator of college success, and our graduation rates have never been higher. So it's not an issue about making public schools fail. Frankly, every indicator is that things are moving in the right direction. And in regard to educators not being attracted to education, I had a daughter who just chose to go into a Title I school as a second career, and she is in a public school in Indiana. So I have I don't think I would ever want written on my headstone that, I tried to ruin the very institution that my daughter chose to work in, because, she's a public school teacher in a Title I school. So I guess this is not an issue. Mike, this really clearly goes back to the issue that I think I made, a comment I made earlier. I believe that for many years we haven't changed our education system. We just haven't changed the systems of education. Mm-hmm. I do believe it is in Gene White and Indianapolis Public Schools, the children who Gene serves. I believe it's in their best interest that he can manage his human capital and recognize and reward his best teachers. There's a recent study out by the TNTP, used to be called the New Teacher Project. It's called the Irreplaceables, and it talks about the incredible impact of outstanding, highly effective teachers and what we need to do to keep them. And a great deal of that is recognition and reward in terms of compensation.
And that sounds like another show for us at some point, what we do to bring new teachers in. We've only got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to try to click off as many of these listener questions as possible and ask that we be brief. We've gotten a question from a listener, email question from a listener named Maureen, who says, why is a donation from the Walton family not germane to this discussion? Donation spell influence. Is the Walton family involved in charter schools in Indiana, or are they in the pipeline to do so? Have you accepted donations from any entity that is sponsoring charter schools here in Indiana? Dr. Bennett, I'm assuming that's you, since you're the only one
first
on the ballot.
The Walton family does contribute to the charter school movement. It contributes to the Charter School Association. This discussion originally was not about charter schools. Mm-hmm. You're actually hearing from the guy who wants this position, who believes this position should be an appointed position, so it shouldn't be part of the election process. But you know what? The election process is about raising money. It's about getting your message out. And I am sure that folks who want to run for this office will be soliciting their own contributions from their own other interests. So that's part of the process. And it is not about influence. Frankly, there are individuals who have made contributions to our campaign that, frankly, don't get what they want.
But I don't know why influence should be an issue. When there's an education issue at the State House, there are folks who show up to testify on behalf of whatever they believe is important about public education, and those people are well-funded. Mm-hmm. And so the Walton Family Foundation has been a great supporter of school choice. As I think any reasonable person would be. You never want to say to any kid, you have to be locked into a situation that doesn't work for you. The issue isn't about, I think, governance, traditional school districts, mm-hmm. charters. The issue is about quality. And at some point, we have to demand for every kid what we want for our own kid. Mm-hmm. I want my kid to go to a great school. The lady down the block wants her kid to go to a great school. And even if you don't have the resources that I have, you ought to have a great school for your kids. And so at some point, we've got to shift away from us versus them. It's not about adversaries. At some point, it should be about quality. If you're running a bad school, I don't care who you are and who's behind you. You should stop. And somebody else should try to do better, I think, on
the
surface.
John, that's exactly the reason. This is exactly the reason, and Gene's very aware of this. It's exactly the reason we have advocated so strongly that all schools that receive public funds in Indiana be assessed on the same performance metrics. If you are a charter school, if you are a school that receives vouchers, if you're a traditional public school, you get your A, B, C, D, F the same exact way. And that is important to Marcus's point that this is about quality.
But is part of the problem, and I guess I'll pick up on that point. Marcus made reference, also used the word adversarial here. There is, let's face it, a lot of rancor built into the discussion about education these days. And it's been that way, I mean, pretty much since that report came out in the 80s, A Nation at Risk, that, you know, really dragged the education into the political discourse in a big way, in a way that it hadn't been for before. Is there any way, in about a minute, we can get past that? I'll start with you, Tony Bennett, and then let Eugene White.
I think we're getting there. I think, you know, first, it has to be a debate, John.
Mm-hmm.
Since A Nation at Risk, we've had A-plus here in Indiana. And you know what? I think part of the problem is we've agreed ourselves into erosion. Mm-hmm. We haven't had a public debate. We spend over 55% of our state budget on public education. And you know what? We haven't had a debate about what's best for public education. We've had a lot of discussion, but we haven't had a real debate. And I think in the last 3 years, we've had that debate. And I think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm. Eugene White, I think I'm going to give you the last word here.
Well, one of the things that we should ask in the process is how our children are, how are we doing? And I think when you ask that in the state of Indiana right now, like Tony said, all of the indicators show improvement and growth. I know when you look at IPS schools and you look at Marion County, we are only one of three districts who have shown improvement on state tests over the last 4 or 5 years. So we are showing improvement. It's going to continue to be somewhat adversarial, but we still have to talk about it and keep working with it, and that's what we're going to do.
I want to thank you all. This has been a fascinating conversation. I feel like we could have done another 3 hours on this. My guests today have been Dr. Tony Bennett, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Dr. Bennett, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Eugene White, IPS Superintendent, thank you for being here, Dr. White.
Thank you, John.
Marcus Robinson, who is the Chancellor for EdPower, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
We will be back next week when we are going to talk about the danger of concussions, just in time for the start of the fall high school and college sports seasons. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Have a great week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsip. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.